I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The world is reacting to President Bush's 13-minute address and his 48-hour ultimatum. The Iraqi leadership called George W. Bush pathetic and dismissed the president's demand that Saddam Hussein go into exile or face war. The UN inspectors left Baghdad overnight. While in Great Britain this morning, embattled Prime Minister Tony Blair made an impassioned speech to Parliament, stressing the importance of the issue.
Because, Mr. Speaker, the outcome of this issue will now determine more than the fate of the Iraqi regime, more than the future of the Iraqi people, for so long brutalized by Saddam, important though those issues are. It will determine the way Britain and the world confront the central security threat of the 21st century, the development of the United Nations, the relationship between Europe and the United States, the relations within the European Union, and the way that the United States engages with the rest of the world. So it could hardly be more important.
Here at home, with uncertainty over whether there will be a war diminished, the stock market rallied and polls show Americans increased their support of war after watching the president speak.
Robin, we're asking, how do you think President Bush did in his speech last night?
I thought he looked like a deer frightened in car headlights. That was all I could think of.
Yeah, I think that a decision had to be made, and at least there is a decision, and that's a good thing. I think now what it boils down to is falling in and supporting the decision that's made, and I think that everybody is behind the president in that.
No, I don't think his case has been very credible or believable from the start.
Reactions to President Bush's speech on a possible war with Iraq.
Well, most Americans are worried about a war with Iraq, but 66% of them approve of the president's decision and believe that the U.S. has done all it can to end the crisis diplomatically. All of this according to a Gallup poll conducted right after the president's address to the nation last night. Joining us on the line from Princeton, New Jersey is Frank Newport. He's editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll organization. And Frank, first of all, what is your overall sense of the poll results?
Approval for Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein, 2/3 approve, 30% disapprove. That's probably the bottom line, and not surprising because all of our polling had been showing leading up to Monday night's speech that the public, generally speaking, behind the idea of military actions.
Your poll, the Gallup poll, showed, despite the support, people are worried?
Yes. Not shockingly, we gave people a list of adjectives and said, now that war appears to be imminent, how much would you say this applies to you? And out of the four adjectives, worried was the one that more Americans than any other picked, that 70%.
What did they think about the success of an attempt to remove Saddam Hussein?
No question that Americans overwhelmingly think that the U.S. military will be successful. Last night, 79% said they thought, yes, the U.S. would remove Saddam Hussein from power if war starts. Only 13%, very low number in polling terms, said they thought the U.S. wouldn't.
In past polls, Americans have said that they only were in favor of war with Iraq with the involvement of the U.N. Obviously, that's not happening. How did they respond last night?
Well, it's the paradox of our polling. Americans consistently say they would like to have U.N. involvement, they would like the U.N. to have voted a second resolution, and yet, when that didn't occur, 69, 71, depending on the poll, percent of Americans said they approve. What's happening is a rally effect, I think, that despite the fact that we don't have the kind of allied support that the public would like, they're saying it's inevitable, so at the last minute we're coming behind our president and supporting the effort regardless.
There was another poll taken last night, we should mention, the Washington Post ABC poll. It showed more women support the war than before. 71% of Americans agree with Mr. Bush that war is the only way to disarm Iraq. A clear majority of Americans wants the U.S. to maintain relations with and not punish France. You also had an interesting result in yours in the Gallup poll, the prediction of the total number of people who may be killed in a war.
Yeah, we gave Americans a choice, and it wasn't just Americans. We made sure we said total, and we said Americans, including Iraqis and others, and we said high, moderate, low, or almost no deaths as a result, and the majority of Americans chose the top two categories. 34% said they thought there would be a high number of deaths, and 37% a moderate number. There's no blinder, so to speak, over the eyes of the American public that if war comes, that there could be some bloodshed.
So interesting, you find that more Americans support a war than before, and more Americans worry that there might be a large number of deaths.
Yes, there was an amazing Newsweek poll over the weekend that showed Americans overwhelmingly think there are going to be all kinds of bad consequences, chemical weapons and new terrorist attacks and what have you. And yet, the majority of Americans support military action in Iraq.
Well, Frank, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll Organization. He spoke to us from Princeton, New Jersey.
Eight or so time zones from the east coast of the United States, more than a quarter of a million Allied soldiers now appear just days away from war, strongly supported, as we just heard, by a majority of the U.S. public. But military commanders and their commander-in-chief know. Even the certain victory most anticipate in Iraq must also ideally be swift. Joining us to discuss that strategy is Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. Hello, Mr. Heyman.
Hello, Bill.
Can you paint a concise picture of what the first day or so of this war will be like?
Well, it's beginning to look as though we're about 48 hours away and that we will probably see some sort of military action starting in the very, very early hours of Thursday morning Baghdad time. And we're expecting some highly selective airstrikes on various targets around southeastern Iraq and the Baghdad area and one of the two of the other main cities, mainly at command and control centers and air defense sites. Now, at the same time, we are expecting, in parallel with the airstrikes, we're expecting a ground assault into Kuwait with the 1st U.S. Marine Division and the 3rd Infantry Division and the 1st U.K. Armored Division. And we're pretty sure that they're going to go for Basra, first of all, in what is basically phase one of this whole operation. So they take Basra and they put an armored screen out to the west of Basra to ensure that the Iraqis can't counterattack. And then we think there's going to be an operational pause there while the effects of what they've done sink in to the regime in Baghdad, with yet another chance for Saddam Hussein to decide whether he goes into exile or not. Then we're looking at phase two, which we think is basically opening the route to Baghdad, and that's quite a lengthy operation. It's 400 kilometers from Basra up to Baghdad. There are some good access roads, but the problem is there are lots and lots of bridges over rivers. And almost certainly the Iraqis are going to blow some of those bridges. So there's going to be pretty extensive military engineer effort to get the bridges back in place and to get the thousands of tons of logistic supplies, fuel, ammunition, food, and all the armored vehicles they need up into the Baghdad area so that if necessary, they can go in phase three and dig Saddam Hussein out of Baghdad. All of this, of course, will be paralleled with some air landings, probably in western Iraq to ensure the Scud box is closed, and some smaller landings in Kurdistan and around the northern oil fields. The main axis of effort out of Kuwait.
How much of a fight do you think most military commanders expect the Iraqis to put up? There seems to be at the heart of some of this strategy that there will be defections.
Well, there's going to be almost certainly a lot of defection. Now, a very clever campaign has been waged by the coalition over the last 3 months. There's been a huge amount of psychological warfare going in. Top commanders are being sent emails, leaflets being dropped, two radio stations broadcasting Allied instructions to stay in their camps, not to come out of their camps, and to surrender as soon as they possibly can. Now, the real question here is not how many are going to defect, but how many are going to fight? 40 to 50% of the Republican Guard, and especially those around Baghdad, may fight. And the Special Republican Guard, with around about 20,000 people in Baghdad, will probably fight. It could be a bit of a messy business for the coalition.
Charles Heyman, we want to thank you very much for speaking with us about what appears to be, as you say, war in just about 48 hours or so.
My pleasure.
Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies.
A caravan of taxis, buses, tractors is reportedly carrying thousands of Kurds away from the front lines in northern Iraq in advance of expected war. Northern Iraq has enjoyed some independence from Iraq, but the Kurdish people there have been battered and betrayed by external factions for years and also fought their own civil war throughout the 90s. Joining us from Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq is Christian Science Monitor reporter Cameron Barr. Hi, Cameron.
Hi.
Well, first of all, what are you seeing there? We're hearing about this exodus away from the front lines, and how much of what's happening there is in response to President Bush's speech?
Well, this morning I was at the town of Chamchamal, which is just at the line that demarcates Iraqi government control and the Kurdish-controlled area. And I met there a family of Kurds from Kirkuk, which is, of course, under Iraqi government control, who had heard coverage of Bush's speech on Radio Sawa, which is a U.S.-funded Arabic language radio station, and decided on the basis of that that the time had come to flee. So they had packed up their kids and two bundles of clothing and gotten into a bus that had brought them from Kirkuk to the Kurdish area, and they were in the process of trying to sort themselves out, you know, with almost nothing, sitting in the dust by the side of the road, and finding a way to go to a relative's village.
Well, what is the feeling there, though? Is it one of panic or resolve? What's the sense?
Well, I think there are the first inklings, actually, of celebration, because they've certainly been battered by the Hussein regime time and again. But I think with Bush's speech and his ultimatum, they have a sense that this is finally going to happen, and they were beginning to celebrate what they saw as the certain end of Saddam Hussein.
Well, and just briefly, what other factors are weighing on this? We've talked about many of them, but the U.S. has been courting Turkey to use its land for air bases. Turkey and the Kurds have a fractious past and a precarious future at best.
Yes. Well, there's some sense of relief among Kurdish officials about the Turkish situation, in part because the Turks have given the Americans such a hard time. And that gives the Kurds reason to think that the Americans will not allow the Turks a free hand in northern Iraq.
And Cameron, as you spend time in the area, we mentioned that there was civil war in this area known as Kurdistan. What is your sense of a prospect for a truly, you know, independent Kurdistan in the future?
Well, this is the great problem. I mean, really, of all oppressed peoples, tend to fight it out amongst themselves before they fight their common enemy. I mean, you travel around, you see, you visit the area controlled by the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, and, you know, as in many parts of the Middle East, you see lots of pictures of martyrs. And the pictures of martyrs around here weren't killed by Saddam Hussein. They were killed by the other Kurdish party, the Kurdistan Democratic Party.
Well, getting back to the present, the Kurds have been gassed in the past by Saddam Hussein. Do you see that fear of a chemical attack now?
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's been very surprising to me arriving here because, of course, like a lot of journalists, I've come here with a chemical suit and gas masks and other sorts of protective equipment. And then you quickly realize that the Kurds have nothing. And I've been here for about 6 weeks now. Ever since the very beginning, Kurdish officials have been telling me that they have relayed requests to the Americans and to the Europeans for some sort of gear and equipment to help protect civilians, and that these requests have been met with sympathy but zero action. And that's the situation as it stands today. The only thing that the Kurds really have to protect themselves against chemical attack are the sorts of things they had back in 1988, and that's to say plastic sheeting, wet towels, that sort of thing.
Well, Cameron, thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Christian Science Monitor reporter Cameron Barr speaking to us from Sulaymaniyah, Iraq.
Just ahead, as the U.S. prepares to go to war with Iraq, we ask, does the United Nations still matter?
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. 8th District Congressman Michael Capuano says President Bush is too quick on the trigger, that the upcoming war is neither moral nor justified. For the story, log on to our website, WBUR.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the 10 o'clock news on WB56, relevant and to the point, with Karen Marinella and Frank Malicote and Emmy Award-winning meteorologist Mike Wonkum. The 10 o'clock news on WB56, Boston's 10 p.m. news leader. And the Boston Design Center, fine furniture, fabrics, antiques, kitchens, bath, and home electronics featured in 75 showrooms on South Boston's waterfront, bostondesign.com. And the White Star Tavern, Copley Square, featuring Scott Pelletier's winter menu, and awarded Best Affordable Wine List by Boston Magazine 2002. White Star Tavern, 617-536-4477. It's 21 minutes past 12.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
So, after months of backroom diplomatic brawling, and some pretty public brawling, too, the United Nations did not get to call the final shot on whether there would be a shooting war with Iraq, raising the question, is the credibility of the UN shot? A question we now pose to two experts on the UN. David Malone is president of the International Peace Academy and a former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. He joins us from New York. Hello, David.
Hello.
And we are also very pleased to welcome Sir Brian Urquhart, whose involvement with the UN began in 1946. He was present at the creation of the institution and now observes, not for the first time, a UN in crisis. Hello, Sir Brian.
Hello.
Sir Brian, the world's superpower has decided to go to war without approval of the Security Council. Can a UN matter that a great power ultimately dismisses when it feels the UN is standing in the way of something it wants to do?
Well, I think this has happened before on a number of occasions. Most recently in Kosovo, when the UN was barred from action by a probable Russian veto. But I think all this talk about irrelevancy is perhaps a little premature. It seems to me this is the equivalent of people running their car into the ditch and then getting out and kicking the car rather than trying to get it back on the road again and make it carry them forward. Because there's no doubt whatsoever that whatever happens on the military side, the sooner the UN gets back into supporting whatever effort is required after the war, the better for everyone concerned.
But these fractures in old alliances leave a tremendous bitterness in their wake. Will the U.S. come back to the UN after the war is over for the UN's approval on things it feels like doing?
I would have thought that it would need to do that. It's got quite a program of problems in the world after Iraq. But I must say that fractures and alliances aren't new either. I mean, I don't know, you probably don't remember, but in 1956, the French and the British invaded Egypt, and they were absolutely clobbered by President Eisenhower. So that there's nothing particularly new about this. And people do come back because they have to.
But David Malone, isn't there something new about a preemptive war, the world's only superpower deciding to launch what it quite explicitly itself calls a preemptive war, not a war of self-defense, as the UN Charter calls for when military force is used?
No, we've seen preemptive wars before. The classic example is the Israeli decision to take on Arab armies preemptively in 1967. So, but where the damage is great, I think, the diplomatic damage, is within Europe. I think the European Union common foreign policy, which clearly was built on a number of hypocrisies and a weak foundation, is flat on its back. I think NATO, which was already in decline after the Kosovo conflict 4 years ago, will be accelerating in its decline. Curiously, the Security Council, which will remain useful to the United States on all sorts of conflicts in which it doesn't want to take the lead, is likely to emerge as not the most damaged international forum.
So, Sir Brian, is the United Nations rather good at waging peace, but not much good at waging war?
Well, I would say that only 13 years ago it displayed a remarkable speed and unanimity in opening up the possibility of waging war on Iraq for invading Kuwait. In fact, it was way ahead of the United States Congress. It was unanimous and it was very quick. So that I'm not sure that the United Nations wasn't incidentally set up to wage war. It was set up to preserve international peace and security, and enforcement measures, i.e., sanctions or, if necessary, war, were a sort of last resort.
If I may come in, I'd simply like to add that the direction of our conversation in some way obscures the fact that President Bush, not for lack of trying, failed absolutely to make his case internationally. The fact that international public opinions, including in very friendly countries like Canada and Britain, failed to respond to the president's call needs to inspire reflection in Washington on its objectives and the way that it goes about trying to bring allied countries on board.
Right. Sir Brian, to sum up then, how, in your long view of it, serious is the crisis that the United Nations finds itself in at the moment?
Well, I think everybody, not just the United Nations, finds themselves in a very serious crisis at the moment. And I suppose that since war is now a foregone conclusion, that all everybody can hope is that it's quick, successful, and has minimum casualties, either civilian or military. But, you know, everybody always talks about the United Nations as if it was some kind of government which really has overall responsibility to these things. The United Nations is a vehicle for governments in which to try to reach agreement on what to do in a difficult situation. And if they can't do that, then they either give up or go around it. I don't think that it's so important to think about the United Nations as to think about the consequences for the world of a course of action involving preventive war, which is a new concept.
David Malone, the essence of the role of the UN in the world now, post this whole experience of the past several months?
Well, I think it's been a sobering shock for the Security Council. That said, the Security Council is going to go on being very useful to the United States in addressing a number of conflicts around the world on which the U.S. doesn't want to adopt the lead. There are many conflicts in Africa and elsewhere where the United States wants to support international action towards peace without taking the lead. And on issues like North Korea, which are extremely sensitive for the United States, it's going to want the Security Council to provide company, the company it so signally failed to attract in its Iraq venture.
The UN, an imperfect but enduring institution in the minds of the two men we've just spoken with. I want to thank David Malone for speaking with us. David is president of the International Peace Academy and a former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. Thank you, David.
Welcome.
And indeed, great thanks to Sir Brian Urquhart, whose involvement with the UN began in 1946. Sir Brian joined us also from New York. Thank you, Sir Brian.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the very latest on looming war.
And we take a special look at the White House Nerve Center, the Situation Room. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, the impending war leads to a talk with former war correspondent Chris Hedges and Michael Ignatieff, director of the Carr Professor of Human Rights Practice at Harvard. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the George Orwell Centenary Conference at Wellesley College, May 1st through 3rd, where writers and scholars examine Orwell's influence on intellectual and political ideas. Orwell2003.com. And Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, with a commitment to banking and investment services in the tradition of the world's leading private banks, bostonprivatebank.com. And Stoneham Theater, presenting John Steinbeck's classic of Mice and Men, March 21st through April 6th, online at stonehamtheater.org. WBUR, the Kennedy Library, the Boston Globe present a free discussion of Vietnam, international justice, terrorism, and public service with former Senator Bob Kerry. That's Monday, March 24th at 5:30, 617-514-1643.
That's the sound of a grand piano without strings. Tomorrow's the last day that your $100 pledge for the news will enter you in a drawing to win this new Yamaha Digital Baby Grand Piano, courtesy of Scotty Piano and Music, featuring new and used instruments and instruction on Route 114 Peabody. See the Yamaha Digital Baby Grand and enter the drawing today at WBUR.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, how will war with Iraq affect congressional debate on the federal budget?
I suspect the administration will be making the case that this is not the best time to oppose the president's policy, so he may get a bump out of that.
And questions still being raised about the Columbia shuttle disaster.
And the big question, of course, is could those images have helped spot whatever damage was up there? And satellite imagery analysts have said, well, you could spot things maybe a couple of inches across, which may have been enough to see the damage that eventually led to the destruction.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. The White House says it could be Saddam Hussein's final mistake. Hussein's son and other Iraqi leaders today rejected the ultimatum issued by President Bush last night, and a defiant Hussein himself appeared on Iraqi TV in uniform for the first time since the end of the 1991 Gulf War. Earlier today, United Nations weapons inspectors left Iraq, another sign that war is imminent. Meanwhile, as British Prime Minister Tony Blair defends himself in Parliament for his support for the war, Secretary of State Colin Powell says 30 countries have joined a coalition of the willing against Iraq. Russian President Vladimir Putin reaffirmed his opposition to the war in a phone call to President Bush today. China's new leader is urging the U.S. to allow weapons inspections to continue, while other countries are lining up behind President Bush. President Hu Jintao told Bush that China wants peace instead of war. Japan's prime minister said, however, that Bush made the right decision, and Australia is offering troops. Also today, the head of the Arab League called off a peacemaking trip to Iraq. The national terror alert system is now at orange. That's the second highest level as war with Iraq looms. Homeland Secretary Chief Security Chief Tom Ridge, who is Secretary of Homeland Security, says local and federal public safety officials are putting in place extra security measures under the Operation Liberty Shield.
While Al-Qaeda and those sympathetic to their cause are still a principal threat, Iraqi state agents, Iraqi surrogate groups, other regional extremist organizations and ad hoc groups, or disgruntled individuals may use this time period to conduct terrorist attacks against the United States in our interest, either here or abroad.
And governors nationwide are being instructed to deploy National Guard and other security officers to specific sites. And petroleum, chemical, and nuclear facilities will also see more security, as well key laboratories for key Agriculture Department buildings. The United States is also preparing for disruptions to financial markets by protecting critical institutions in the event of a terrorist attack. Government's taking a number of steps to ensure those institutions can function during hostilities, although it will not disclose those steps because of security concerns. The numbers. Dow is up 5 points at this hour at 8,147. The Nasdaq is off 4 points at 1,388. It's 33 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Acela Express, offering 10 departures every weekday to New York and Washington, D.C. Acela Express. Keep moving. More information at Amtrak.com. And ColorTech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumer. Locations include Campus Camera in Kenmore Square, 251 Newbury Street, and 727 Atlantic Avenue. Red Sox play the Twins in exhibition baseball this afternoon. The Bruins play the Coyotes out in Phoenix. And the Celtics will be at the Fleet Center tonight, and their opponent will be the New Jersey Jets. The forecast calls for mostly sunny this afternoon, but a lower high than earlier predicted, just 45 degrees tops. Tonight will be clear and brisk with lows in the middle 20s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, warmer highs 50 to 55, or rather that's Thursday. And then Friday, rain likely with partly cloudy in the afternoon and highs of 50 to 55. Right now, it's 40 degrees at 12:35. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This week, lawmakers in Washington are trying to come up with a spending blueprint for the next fiscal year without knowing the cost of one of the big-ticket items, war in Iraq. What will happen to the president's planned tax cuts? How much will federal spending be limited, and who will be hurt by cuts in spending? And how will the war impact all of this? These are the big questions for the Republican-controlled Congress. Joining us on the line is Robert Bixby. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition, a bipartisan group that advocates for balanced budgets. He's speaking to us from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, but Capitol Hill is facing these questions as the country faces a deficit of at least $100 billion every year for the next decade. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office. And yet both the House and Senate budget committees include almost all of President Bush's tax cuts in their plans. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that reality needs to set in Washington here. We can't have it all. We can't have big tax cuts, a prescription drug benefit for Medicare, which would be very expensive no matter how you do it, and a war agenda, which is also quite expensive, and continue other government services at the same level. Something has to give, and so far I don't think either party is willing to make the hard choices.
In fact, you mentioned Medicare. The Medicare insolvency rate, it's being reported today, has been moved up from 2030 to 2026, so even more in jeopardy than it was yesterday. What are some of the conversations that you think that will go on the floor?
Well, I think that there's a great deal of skepticism about passing another large tax cut. That's really the central issue.
Speak specifically to the idea of eliminating the tax on corporate dividends. Do you think that that will live?
the fact that the president is pushing it gives it a high profile, but I think there are a lot of people I'm hearing, particularly from Republicans, that are questioning whether this is the right time to go about it. Nancy Johnson from Connecticut is certainly one of them. Also, two very prominent senators, both from Maine, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, have said that they wouldn't go along with the Senate budget resolution, and of course, Senator Chafee from Rhode Island has had the same aversion. So a lot of Northeastern Republicans are the ones that are holding the key votes right now.
Well, the estimates of the war with Iraq are $100 billion just for combat. Then there's the cost of occupation and rebuilding. How much do you think that's going to impact the conversation this week? And will legislators feel, you know, that they're not supporting the president if they're not supporting his plan?
I think you've put your finger on an important dynamic that people haven't focused on yet. The conventional wisdom is that that will provide sticker shock to people who will begin thinking that we need to scale back on some other things. However, I suspect the administration will be making the case that this is not the best time to oppose the president's policy, so he may get a bump out of that.
Hmm. So do you think anything can come out of this discussion this week?
We're going to have to wait and see what happens with the budget resolution. I suspect that they may put off voting on it until next week, until they get the supplemental spending request from the administration, just so they're playing with a full deck, so to speak, and have a better idea what challenges they have in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more question for you on the economy. We read that the stocks are surging because of the sense that there might be a short war. Oil prices are going down. How will this current economy impact the conversation about a future budget?
Even if the economy were to suddenly surge, as some people think it might, I suspect that the political decision has already been made to do some sort of fiscal stimulus, so that will probably work into the budget resolution no matter what.
Robert, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Robert Bixby is executive director of the Concord Coalition based in Arlington, Virginia.
Well, as we've just heard, the White House is expected to ask Congress next week for money to fund a war in Iraq. The likely sum, around $90 billion, is on top of money already appropriated for the military buildup in the Gulf and does not include the cost of any post-war reconstruction. Estimates for the cost of a war have varied widely, and the president has come under fire for not providing his own numbers before now. Stephen Kosiak has looked at the potential cost. He joins us from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
$75 to $90 billion. That's how much the president is reportedly going to ask Congress for next week, Steve. Senator Joe Biden, though, today said the cost was $100 billion and rising. What does your calculator tell you?
Well, it's very difficult to estimate what the cost of the war will be at this point because obviously we don't know how long it's going to last, what level of hostility we'll face, and the total number of troops that will be involved. But our own estimate is that it's likely to cost something like $35 billion, perhaps a bit less if it goes very smoothly. But that's just the cost of the war itself. Peacekeeping operations after the war could cost anywhere from $25 billion to $100 billion over a period of 5 years, depending on how many troops the U.S. decides it needs to keep deployed in the region. And then on top of that, of course, there would be costs of reconstruction, humanitarian assistance, and other kinds of non-military assistance.
Now, there's one statistic out there that a Yale University economist compiled. He admits it's a worst-case scenario number, but he calculates at $2 trillion what it could cost the United States if things went badly. What do you make of a number like that?
Well, I think, these estimates all illustrate very graphically that there is a lot of underlying uncertainty about any conflict you go into. I mean, it's always a roll of the dice. And in a worst case, of course, costs could be substantially higher for the war itself than we have estimated. But more importantly, the cost could be much more significant in terms of economic costs or related to a spike in the oil prices if the war went very badly.
Now, is there a good economic side to this? Is there a rosy scenario?
Well, I think the hope of the Bush administration is that things will calm down in the Middle East and that we will be able to develop Iraq into a peaceful democracy with a robust and growing economy. And that is, that's a possibility. I think a lot of people are concerned that given the level of ethnic tension within the country and other tensions within the region, that that's going to be a very tough thing to do.
In your opinion, as someone who looks at this closely, has the administration been disingenuous about costs, or does it simply, like all of us, have a problem estimating what something so unpredictable as a war will cost?
Well, I think it is a difficult thing to estimate, and so no one should expect the administration to come up with some precise estimate for what the war or follow-on peacekeeping or rebuilding is going to cost. On the other hand, I do think the administration should have done a better job of coming up with at least a range of estimates for what it might cost, because these are real costs that we'll have to incur, and we may have to make trade-offs between other kinds of priorities like tax cuts or entitlement expansion.
You know, one aspect of the administration's approach to all this, Ari Fleischer, the White House press spokesman, brought it up just the other day, that Iraqis will be expected, through oil revenues and other revenues, to pay for a lot of their own reconstruction costs. How realistic do you think that is?
The hope is certainly over the long term that the Iraqi oil industry will be able to help support that country and contribute greatly to the reconstruction. I think in the near term, over the next couple of years, it's not clear how successful that will be, because there may be a lot of damage done to the oil industry during a conflict. It's already decayed a lot over the past decade. So I think it'll be some time before it ultimately is a big driver of the Iraqi economy.
Steve, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Steve Kosiak is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C.
Still to come, as the investigation continues into the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy, there are concerns about the future of the whole shuttle program, especially in light of war.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Pollution tests conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency in the days following the collapse of the World Trade Center do not support the agency's own contention that the air around the site was safe to breathe. An internal memo from the independent federal agency investigating the EPA in the aftermath of 9/11 blasts that safe air assessment. The memo was obtained by the Sacramento Bee newspaper, and joining us on the line is the paper's environmental writer, Chris Bowman. Chris, for many Ground Zero workers, the findings in this memo that the air wasn't safe to breathe is not going to be a surprise, is it?
That's right. The news was greeted with no surprise. People knew, from firefighters to volunteers to cleanup workers, knew that the air couldn't be safe. They were breathing in gravel. Their tongues were coated with dust. The acrid smell prevailed for days and even weeks after the blast.
What did the Office of Inspector General, or OIG, say about, what was wrong with the EPA testing?
Well, typically, for the public at large, the EPA says it should be no more than a 1 in a million chance that such an exposure would cause cancer. Well, in this case, they declared the air safe when the risk was 1 in 10,000. And that's even a higher risk than would be assigned to workers in industrial situations.
Right. Well, but EPA Administrator Christy Whitman said publicly just 1 week after the attacks that the air around Ground Zero was safe to breathe. So tell us what the memo says, if anything, about some of the politics behind that.
The Inspector General apparently sees this as unusual. They're devoting quite a bit of time interviewing the former EPA Chief of Staff and others who were players in putting out the word to the public. In fact, they quoted that the former EPA Chief of Staff acknowledged that the content of the World Trade Center press releases was heavily influenced by President Bush's Council on Environmental Quality.
And to add to that, as you write, the EPA had an ombudsman at the time, Robert Martin, who testified before a Senate subcommittee that the EPA had provided erroneous information. He later resigned, saying that Christy Whitman tried to silence him, which is something she denies. So that, I'm sure, will be further looked at. In fact, the OIG says it's not going to comment on any of these preliminary conclusions because the investigation is ongoing. In the meantime, what are you hearing from people in New York?
The reaction I'm getting is, we knew this all along. More than half of the Ground Zero workers screened by health experts nearly a year after the attacks continue to suffer from lung, ear, nose, and throat problems. And there's a team of scientists who are expert at measuring those particulates, those tiny things in the air from such an explosion. They're coming out with a study saying that some of the worst pollution came weeks after, in the form of these aerosols that were emanating from that inferno in the pile of debris.
So it actually got worse.
It got
in the aftermath.
And it got worse. And everyone knows, can picture in their mind, the horrible situation in Kuwait. when those oil fields were set afire, they're saying some of these dangerous particulates, the ones that can pass your natural body defenses and into deep in your lung, the ones that potentially cause lung and heart problems, three times higher than those that the same team had measured in Kuwait, in Kuwaiti oil fields. I think that's something a lot of people don't realize. They, you know, they think of the dust and everything in the initial blast, but this is more than just dust raining down. In fact, it is believed that the more dangerous stuff is the stuff you couldn't see. Scientists compare it to, well, it's like having a power plant at ground level with no stack.
Well, Chris, thank you so much, as I said, and as you say in your article, to be continued. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Bowman is an environmental writer for the Sacramento Bee.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tonight at 7, it's On Point with Tom Ashbrook. The peace movement at home and abroad, does war mean that they failed? And Washington's vision for Iraq post-Saddam Hussein. That's tonight at 7, On Point with Tom Ashbrook. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Bentley College. Applications are currently being accepted for fall graduate school classes. Details at bentley.edu or 800-442-GRAD. And Luma Sales, serving the investment needs of institutional, high net worth, and mutual fund clients for over 75 years with comprehensive in-house research. Online at lumassales.com. This spring, join NPR's Scott Simon and Robert Siegel on our next Citizens of the World tour, exploring the natural wonders of Africa. To learn more about the trip, call 800-909-9287. It's 1248. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
6 weeks after it disintegrated in the upper atmosphere, the space shuttle Columbia is being slowly reassembled in a hangar in Florida. The remains of the seven astronauts have been laid to rest, but questions about the cause of the disaster remain. Justin Mullins is the Boston editor of New Scientist magazine. He's been covering the Columbia investigation. He joins us in the studio. Justin, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, NASA established a board of investigation to take a look at this accident. Mm-hmm. There are also congressional hearings underway, but it's still very early in the process. Even so, what is the leading theory on the breakup of the shuttle?
Well, the big smoking gun that everyone has been looking at is this piece of debris that fell from the shuttle 82 seconds into flight and seemed to impact on the orbiter somewhere. And we know that several days later, the orbiter disintegrated as it re-entered the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can those two events be linked?
But we hear that this foam that you speak of that might have broken off, it weighs as much as the foam in an ice cooler. So how could it cause a shuttle to fall apart?
Well, that's one of the big questions. And it may not have been foam. It's possible that it could have been ice. And if it was a suitcase-sized piece of ice, then that could create a considerable impact, rather like a safe hitting the side of the shuttle at several hundred miles per hour. And that could cause a kind of breach that would eventually lead to the destruction of the shuttle.
So it seems as if everyone agrees that the surface of the shuttle was damaged. Is it that obvious that that then links to the breakup of the shuttle?
It's not obvious at all, and that's the chain of events that lead from the damage of the thermal protection system, which is this skin that protects the shuttle as it comes in during re-entry. It's not obvious at all that that damage could lead to the breakup of the shuttle, so a big question is how. And it looks as if what a breach allows is this very red-hot plasma to enter inside the shuttle, and the plasma itself works like a blowtorch, cutting away the aluminum inside the shuttle, eventually leading to its destruction. But up until now, engineers had always thought that relatively minor damage that would be caused by an impact of the type we described would not be enough to allow plasma to wreak that kind of damage. But clearly, something's wrong with this picture, and the Accident Investigation Board have got to try and work out exactly where that all these pieces can fit together.
And why did they not pay attention to some concerns that were expressed before the accident? That's another big question. Let's talk about some of those. It's come out that NASA engineers exchanged a number of email messages about this possible wing damage before the shuttle fell apart. What's the thinking about whether those discussions should have been taken more seriously?
Well, within hindsight, obviously they should have been taken more seriously. But in every shuttle mission, there are always concerns that have to be discussed. And one thing that engineers look at is the worst-case scenario. And so it's normal to a certain extent for emails to fly around discussing worst-case scenarios. Right now,
Obviously, people are looking at it thinking, well, we should have been able to spot this. And so one of the big questions for the next investigation board is, what is the process of decision-making that ensured that those emails weren't taken as seriously as perhaps they should have been?
And we should say again that the emails were voicing what concern?
Concerns that the damage to the shuttle caused by this foam, or whatever it may have been, could be great enough to lead to uncontrolled heating on re-entry, which is what eventually caused the shuttle to fall apart.
We also read that at one point NASA was offered military spy satellites to look at the shuttle while in orbit, and that offer was rejected.
There was all kinds of confusion about what actually went on within NASA, but it was certainly discussed that they should ask for these pictures to be taken. And then that request was quashed by NASA senior management. And so again, the question is, why was that request quashed? Another request went through. There were two separate requests for this. And instead of being a definitive request for pictures, the request was downgraded to, well, just fit it in if you can. And as a result, the images weren't taken. And the big question, of course, is could those images have helped spot whatever damage was up there? And satellite imagery analysts have said, well, you could spot things maybe a couple of inches across, which may have been enough to see the damage that eventually led to the destruction.
Well, one NASA official was quoted in an article that I read as saying that one of the reasons that the spy satellite pictures weren't used is that there was nothing that could have been done anyway.
That's one of the things that, to my mind, doesn't ring true about NASA's approach to this entire accident. Because if you can imagine that photographs have been taken showing there was damage to the wing and that these people were up there in orbit, NASA would have pulled out the stops to get them back. Every single technical mind in the US that had relevant experience would have been put to work in it. And Atlantis, one of the other space shuttles, was ready to take off within a month or so. Imagine that you could put the astronauts on short rations. The question would then be, how long could they have survived? Could it have been weeks or months while they were still in orbit with this damaged wing?
In other words, conserve their energy and their food and their fuel?
And their oxygen. Mm. How long could they have survived? Would that period have been long enough to get Atlantis up into orbit? And then could anything have been done? I mean, you could have taken a whole load of spacesuits up, for example, that would have allowed the astronauts on board Columbia to transfer over to Atlantis, which would have been a very dangerous maneuver in itself. And would NASA have decided that that was the best course of action, or would they have risked an attempted re-entry? Mm. I mean, these are all questions that we can look at in hindsight, for which there are no answers one way or another. But the statement that nothing could have been done is one of the things that doesn't ring true about NASA's initial response to this accident.
You mentioned Atlantis. It was the next scheduled shuttle flight.
That's right.
NASA has announced plans to resume those flights this fall. How does that timing sound to you? Were you surprised?
Well, I think the fall is really a goal. I don't think they've actually announced the plans to launch at that time, because they can't launch until they've determined what the cause of the accident would be. And if they never determine what the cause of the accident would be, it's very difficult to see how they can continue manned spaceflight in the way they had done before. They've really got to iron out pinpoint exactly what the problem is, and then ensure that it cannot happen again. And until they've done that, they can't resume flights. And so it's too early right now to be saying when they will be flying, but they're hoping for the fall.
There are astronauts in space right now. What about the International Space Station?
Well, there are three astronauts in space right now, and it looks as though the crew is going to be reduced to two to conserve supplies. The big question is, how on earth are we going to keep the International Space Station supplied with fuel and with food and with oxygen? The only way of getting to it right now is through the Russian Soyuz capsules, and Russia says it doesn't have enough money to build those for the future. So it's asking the US for money. Mm-hmm. It wants $100 million. It's not clear whether NASA is going to pay it or not, but something has to be done to keep these guys supplied with the things they need.
All of this is costing money, which brings me to this question. We have war looming. How much does a war impact NASA?
Well, clearly in a time of war, minds are focused in other directions. But of course, the world is a very complex place, and there is another player coming onto the block in the form of China. And China has announced plans to put the first Chinese astronaut in space in October. And I can imagine that it could be very humiliating for NASA to be of Russia, the US and China, the only one who can't put a human in space. And so it's quite possible that another space race will develop because of this extra pressure from the Chinese. But as you say, all those things could be put on hold if the war in Iraq spreads or becomes much more important on the financial and military horizon.
Well, Justin, thank you.
Pleasure.
Justin Mullins is the Boston editor of New Scientist magazine.
Before we go, a wrap-up of recent developments toward likely war with Iraq. Defiance from Iraq, where the leadership called President George W. Bush pathetic and rejected U.S. demands that the Iraqi president, Saddam Hussein, go into exile. On Iraqi television today, Hussein appeared in full Iraqi military uniform for the first time since the 1991 Gulf War. China demands that UN inspections continue in Iraq, though inspectors have left Baghdad, along with most diplomats and some journalists.
Also, Prime Minister Tony Blair delivered an impassioned speech today in the British Parliament. He asked lawmakers to support his decision to join the United States in a war against Iraq. That vote is expected to pass, but many members of his Labour Party are expected to vote against his handling of the crisis. A senior cabinet minister, Robin Cook, and two junior ministers have already resigned in protest.
And today, despite backing the U.S. of the use of force in Iraq, Spanish Prime Minister Jose Maria Aznar ruled out sending troops to take part in a U.S.-led attack, but added he would deploy military personnel, equipment, and warplanes to defend Iraq, to defend Turkey. In Russia, the lower house of parliament indefinitely postponed a vote on ratifying a U.S.-Russia nuclear arms treaty because of the U.S. threat of war.
From Yemen, news that a man shot and killed three Western oil workers, including an American, and wounded a fourth before shooting himself dead. And here at home, Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that 30 nations have joined with the United States in a coalition of the willing to bring down Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. They include Afghanistan, Japan, Spain, and South Korea. And Powell said, another 15 have quietly promised their support.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.com. MathWorks.com.